This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. On today's program, we're going to hear a report from trumpet writer Richard Palmer about fintech. That's blockchain and other financial technologies that could have a huge impact on the world economy in the time ahead. I'm going to talk myself about a couple of angry emails that I received over what I would consider a basic common sense point regarding the importance of modesty. At the end of the show, I'll conclude with a few words about positive, productive relationships between older people and youths. But first, we're going to look at the extraordinary events happening this week in Jerusalem. To learn about this, we have via Skype from Jerusalem, trumpet writer Brent Noctegal. Hello, Brent.
Hello.
So Monday was a historic day, the U.S. formally inaugurating its embassy in Jerusalem, and this, of course, represents America recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. Tell us about that and how people are reacting to that in Israel.
In Israel, it's been quite a positive event. You could even sense that if you watched the broadcast, the live broadcast. It just took place about a mile and a half away from where I am right now, so very close, right on the border between West and East Jerusalem, but still technically in West Jerusalem, where the consulate is, that is now the embassy. And just the feeling of adulation that this is finally something that is taking place, correcting a wrong. All of Israel looks at Jerusalem as their capital, whether they're religious or not. It's a no-brainer for them. And so for the United States to finally come along and say, yeah, we deem this to be the capital of your nation as well, was really encouraging for Israel, because obviously Israel has a lot of enemies. We're even seeing that today in the aftermath of the events that took place on the Gaza border. And even on Tuesday afternoon, the UN Security Council sat down to have a meeting about that. So you can see a lot of the opposite perspective saying that this embassy move really did cause unnecessary deaths of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, when Israelis don't see it as that. They see them as disconnected issues completely. This was just basically the United States catching up on what is already believed to be true amongst Israelis.
I definitely want to talk about the Palestinian response and the violence that has happened. But just to remain focused on the declaration of the embassy move itself for a bit longer, it was really interesting how much of a religious tone all of those proceedings and the ceremony had.
Yeah, I was surprised by that completely, actually, watching it. It was bookended by two prayers, a pastor of a Baptist church and another one at the end, I believe, from the United States, popular religious figures. And these prayers that they gave in front of a largely Israeli audience, a largely Jewish audience, and it was very surprising to me. I would just like to quote a little bit from an article. This is from the Times of Israel yesterday. It's by Raphael Aaron, and he talks about how jubilant everybody was. But then he focuses on how that these prayers given by these two men from the United States basically overstated the fact that, basically they said that David, or he said that kind of King David, the founder of Jerusalem as the state of capital of the state of Israel, fell into the background, and we had Trump taking on this messianic type role here. This is what he said. He said, speaker after speaker hailed his recent decisions. This is speaking of Trump, to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital and to withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal, describing Trump as a modern day messiah who courageously stands up for the truth where lies have long prevailed, a leader of historic stature who protects the national interests of the U.S. and Israel like no one before him. And so then these pastors got up and gave these prayers saying, we want to thank you, God, for the tremendous leadership of our great president. Without President Trump's determination, resolve, and courage, we would not be here today. And I believe I speak for every one of us when I say I thank you every day that you have given us a president who boldly stands on the right side of history, but more importantly, stands on the right side of you, O God, when it comes to Israel. So this is right at the beginning of this declaration, and you have this pastor getting up there saying that Mr. Trump is acting on behalf of God right now, and this is obvious to him. And then at the end, you kind of had that same type of of speech. This was from Pastor John Hagee. This was at the end of it. He said, "We thank you, O Lord, for President Donald Trump's courage in acknowledging to the world a truth established 3,000 years ago that Jerusalem is and always shall be the internal capital of the Jewish people." And then he said, "Can I get a hallelujah?" And everyone in the audience said a hallelujah. And that might not sound weird for an American audience, but living in Israel for on and off for about a decade now, in the last 2 years straight, for a Jewish audience, they haven't really seen much of that before.
That's really interesting.
And so they were exposed to that. But that was just surprising to me that they would have these pastors and the American led delegation would feel completely comfortable voicing those prayers in the name of Jesus Christ, the Messiah, in front of these Jewish people. But that said, we know that the evangelical support for the state of Israel probably even trumps the support of Israelis for the state of Israel. Mm-hmm. That's a running joke over here. But when we saw that on full display at this opening ceremony.
Yeah, very, very interesting in light of that opening chapter in Gerald Flory's booklet, Great Again, where he talks about that religious connection between Donald Trump and the evangelicals in the United States, and how there are prophetic echoes in that relationship. So looking at Israel and Benjamin Netanyahu receiving this kind of support, not only from the United States, but quite a few other nations as well that seem to be following America's lead in at least showing their support for this move. I guess there are a few nations already that are talking about moving their embassies there as well. But in the meantime, Netanyahu is also enjoying, Donald Trump pulling out of the Iran deal, a certain amount of resurgence in his own leadership. And it looks like, you know, Israel is enjoying somewhat of a resurgence nationally. Stephen Fleury has been bringing this out on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, just how when you view this in light of what Gerald Fleury has been saying about this God saving Israel temporarily through this American president, it is interesting to view what's happening in Israel in that context.
For sure. And I think, you know, those comments about Mr. Trump really revitalizing the United States for a time and God using him to give it a boost, we do see that. The knock-on effects with that, with his relationship with Israel, if you talk about him pulling out of the Iran deal, being hand-in-hand with Israel in that, then this decision as well, you look at even the State Department, how they came out and said about the attacks on the Gaza border, that Hamas, we deem Hamas fully responsible for those deaths. Yeah. That took place. I think it's the United States and Australia, the only ones that have come out favorable in that instance. And so you do see Mr. Netanyahu and Israel as a whole feeling jubilant right now. They have the capital being recognized. You even had the winner of Eurovision being an Israeli, which means the Eurovision Song Contest is going to come to Israel, which is, again, outside an American audience, a European audience. This thing is massive, Eurovision, and that's going to bring even more attention to Israel in the future. And so, yeah, times are good. Times are good for the Israeli state, as far as they see it, as well as the leadership of Mr. Netanyahu. You even had some commentators coming out and saying that he is the greatest statesman in Israel's history. And while that may be the case, you don't hear people normally, Israeli commentators, talking about their own current leaders in that way. Normally they have to be dead or wait a few decades before they'll do that thing, that type of thing.
It has caused the accusations of corruption that had been dogging Netanyahu. You haven't been hearing about those either. So just in the interest of looking at the bigger picture here, you actually posted I guess it was a social media post that you put where it was on the Watch Jerusalem website, an excerpt from Daniel Pipes, where he was talking about Donald Trump, his recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital, possibly being part of a larger strategy that might not work in Israel's interest in the long run. Can you explain about that?
Yeah, so even looking into Bible prophecy, we can see from specific prophecy in Zechariah chapter 11 that there is going to be a break between the United States and Israel. And we don't see that. In fact, we see the complete opposite right now. Back during President Obama's time, we could say, well, that was happening, obviously. And really, the damage from that. It still does exist, and yet the relationship is really good now. Well, Daniel Pipes comes out and says that, well, this move by Mr. Trump, we shouldn't, you know, be too giddy about this, because there might be some follow-up steps that take place where we might see him ask Israelis things that they wouldn't be willing to give up or aren't willing to give up in search of a negotiated peace with the Palestinians. That, of course, hasn't left his mind. You had Jason Greenblatt and Jared Kushner, both of them there at the opening of the embassy. They're the ones that are charged by Mr. Trump at bringing peace between the Palestinians and the Israelis. So maybe there is something else on the cards. This is what Daniel Pipes wrote. He said this. Turning to the Middle East, Trump has two grand priorities, reducing the Iranian threat and accomplishing the ultimate deal of bringing an end to the Arab-Israeli conflict. The two goals are related because the only way to build a powerful alliance against Iran is by including Israel. That in turn means resolving the Palestinian issue. And so he says he's got a couple of steps that Trump's doing. Step one for this, give the Saudi leadership what it wants so that they can come on board to be the anti-Iranian alliance. Step two, do the same for Israel. Give it what it longs for, a U.S. embassy in Jerusalem. And then he says step three, do the same thing for the Palestinians. Palestine with a capital also in Jerusalem. That is what he expects. And there has been discussions that have been leaked that there might be another announcement soon that says that East parts of East Jerusalem, maybe not everything that they want, but at least parts of East Jerusalem, that Trump is willing to call that the future capital of the Palestinian state. So Daniel Pipes has received a lot of flack over this, over his tweet saying, hey, don't get too excited about this. This could backfire in Israel. There's no free lunch when it comes to these things from the American president. Mm-hmm. And we could see that, which in the very near future, Mr. Trump doing something similar for the Palestinians.
And in the meantime, when you look at the way that the Palestinians are handling this, Stephen Fleury talked about this on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, just the opportunistic approach that Hamas is taking with the Gaza border and the way that they're throwing really innocent people, or say their weakest members of their society over there in the front, and leaving the gunmen behind. Maybe you could just talk a little bit about that, what the way that they're handling things strategically.
Yeah, they've been very strategic about how they're approaching this on the Gaza border. I think Israelis have interviewed Israeli security forces have interviewed a number of Palestinians about this. And what they've discovered is part of the strategy of Hamas is to allow the civilians, the women, children, and men to go approach the border and try and break through the border themselves. And then the Hamas are generally in the background, ready to take advantage of that, coming to Israel and kidnap, do whatever to Israeli citizens. And so that's their goal. And even the timing of this on Monday was interesting, because really the Nakba day, or the catastrophe day, is Tuesday. And you would expect that to be the big showdown, because that's the celebration of the 70 years when they were ousted from this land back in 1948. But they chose to do the big 50,000 people march on Monday. And they timed it precisely to be at the exact time. To ratchet up the tension at the exact time that the opening was taking place. And so you would have maximum footage or coverage from media all over the world, CNN, BBC, Sky News. They had split footage of the violence on the Gaza border and then the ceremony inside Jerusalem, to try and put these two together and say, look at the Americans, look at the Prime Minister of Israel, he's celebrating, and look at all the dying happening on the Gaza border. That was perfectly orchestrated by Hamas when they wanted to set that off. In fact, Israel released late Tuesday footage of some Hamas fighters with grenades, pipe bombs, weapons, actually approaching the border, intending to come into, with bolt cutters, intending to come into Israel. And actually firing on Israeli soldiers right before the ceremony took place. And Israel, as they do, they release this a day after and say to the world, see, this is what we are confronting. We're not killing innocent people. We are trying to attack the Hamas operatives that are hiding behind the civilians that Hamas is using as civilian shields.
Yeah. Yeah, and really Hamas has a long history of exactly these kinds of tactics, where they're trying to drum up as much international sympathy for their cause by throwing the weakest members of their community into harm's way. Then whenever there are any casualties, then they play those up as much as they possibly can. And you have a media that is extremely complicit and willing to promote that as much as they can. The split screen that you're talking about just being one example. It is extraordinary to see this happening. And as Stephen Fleury brought out on his program, the truth is generally buried in the middle of all of that. This is one unique instance where what you hear coming out of the American administration, it's just refreshing to hear something that is much closer to the truth than what you would typically get from a foreign government. Even the I forget the official, the American official who basically said, we're not going to demand that Israel show restraint in defending itself. Just kind of a refreshing change of pace from what you're accustomed to hearing.
It certainly is. And Israelis are very thankful. A lot of Israelis don't really like Mr. Trump in his personality. He does personify, and we were talking about in a trumpet meeting a couple of days ago, how he does personify the quintessential American to many outsiders, loud, bombastic, somewhat arrogant. But at the same time, they look at the fruits. They look at what is done. They look that he's finally recognizing truths as far as the relationship with Israel goes, Israel's right to the land, Israel's right to Jerusalem, Israel's right to defend itself. Finally, they say, we have an American president that speaks those truths and actually acts on those truths as well. Yeah, so it is going to have to take a lot, I think, to fray this relationship in the future, because right now, Israel and the United States are walking step by step in a way they haven't done, at least the administration and Israel, in a way that they have never done before.
Any thoughts just to finish, Brent, what you're watching for, looking at this from the standpoint of Bible prophecy, what we might expect in the time ahead, or any additional resources that you would point people to just keep that prophetic perspective in their news watching?
Well, there's a couple of articles I would read. I would go back and go to thetrumpet.com and read the one that Mr. Stephen Fleury wrote just a couple of days ago about this. It's called The Vital Perspective on the Jerusalem Embassy Move. It shows you about this relationship forming with the United States right now and why that's prophetic. But also I would look at just our booklet, King of the South, because that really brings in Iran into the picture. And even what's come out since is that Iran has been funding this March of Return. Shin Bet, the intelligence agency over here, released those findings yesterday. Iran is behind even this on the Gaza border by funding Hamas. And that has a lot of implications, Bible prophecy-wise, as far as how much Iran is going to use its proxies to pressure the state of Israel over Jerusalem. So they can go ahead and read King of the South about that.
Fantastic. We sure appreciate your time. We've been talking with trumpet writer Brent Noctegal, who is there in Jerusalem and following these historic events of this past week. Thanks so much, Brent.
No problem.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
What do you know about fintech, Bitcoin, blockchain, and other similar financial technologies are worth keeping your eye on, as we will now hear in this report from Richard Palmer.
Bitcoin, blockchain, fintech, cryptocurrency. These are all new terms that have been all over the news recently. But are they important? The experts can't agree on the answer to that question. These are either new miracle working technologies that are going to change the world, or some of the most overhyped developments in all time. Who is right? Well, I have no idea. There are a lot of good arguments on both sides, but Bible prophecy does give us an important reason to watch these technologies. In 1984, the Plain Truth founder and editor Herbert W. Armstrong wrote that a massive banking crisis in America could suddenly result in triggering European nations to unite as a new world power larger than either the Soviet Union or the US. This was a forecast based on Bible prophecy. Revelation 17 and 18 describe a beast power, a symbol of a great empire. This beast has seven heads, which are symbols of seven successive resurgences. Revelation 17 and verse 10 says there are seven kings, five are fallen, and one is. The other is not yet come, and when he comes, he must continue for a short space. So in other words, this empire has seven phases. Each head symbolizes a different ruler or a different dynasty or time period, and these dynasties, these periods, come one after the other. At the time that this prophecy was revealed, five of these rulers were gone. One is, one was on the scene, and one would come later. So this passage confirms that this is talking about successive rulers. Between these periods of power, the Bible says that this beast, this political power, appears to be dead. Revelation 17 and verse 8 says that it was and it is not until it shall ascend out of the bottomless pit. It disappears from the world scene. The start of this chapter tells us that this beast is ridden by a woman, which, you know, biblical prophecy symbolizes a church. So what we have prophesied and described here in Revelation 17 and 18 is a series of empires that rise and fall that have similar characteristics but carry on over a period of centuries, and they're all very strongly influenced by a major church. Where in the world have we seen that? There's only one place that could possibly meet that description: Europe. Revelation 17 and 18 is describing this European power. It's gone through six resurrections already, and the seventh is now rising. What we're soon going to see is a united European empire, and the Bible is clear that this empire has enormous financial power. Revelation 18 says that when this European power eventually falls, the merchants of the earth shall weep and mourn over her because they were made rich by her. It was a great trading power. The Bible also describes this power as Tyre. The Phoenicians of the ancient Middle Eastern city of Tyre were famous around the world as merchants. And so the Old Testament talks about this new coming economic power often in the same terms, like Tyre. Isaiah 23, for example, describes this modern Tyre joining a mart of nations. And this mart of nations includes powers in the east like China and like Japan. Ezekiel 27 refers to the same power. Here God calls this modern Tyre a merchant of the people for many isles, and it describes this modern Tyre as doing business with merchants all around the world. So here at the Trumpet, we're watching for the rise of a European economic superpower. Revelation chapter 13 is a slightly different prophecy of the same power, and it says that no man will be able to buy or sell without this power's approval. So not only is it a great trading empire, but the government also has an authoritarian control over the people and over the economy. So the Bible's got a lot to say about this coming European power's economics. It's going to dominate global trade. Well, Europe doesn't dominate global trade right now. The dollar is the world's reserve currency. America, the United States, sits at the heart of the global financial system. So the Bible prophesies that there will be a revolution in finance. Well, we do see lots of people already talking about a revolution in finance when it comes to brand new financial technology. These new high-tech implements like Bitcoin that are designed to be electronic currencies, online currencies, and people are talking about these potentially changing the world. So could fintech, this new financial technology, have something to do with this prophesied revolution? Well, Mr. Armstrong did say it would be a financial crisis that helps bring Europe together. And we can already see how that kind of financial crisis could play out when you look at the euro crisis and how there's already a lot of pressure on European nations to unite, driven by the kind of slow rolling financial crisis that we've seen since 2007, since 2008. So will financial technology have a role to play in building this new European economic superpower? Well, Europe will have to do something to build a new financial system. It's prophesied to do so in the Bible. If there is an American financial crisis, like Mr. Armstrong said, that forces Europe to unite, they would have to build this financial system in the wake of a crisis. Someone would have to come along and rebuild Europe's economy. Who could that be? Well, if you're a regular listener to the show, you'll know that we have got our eyes here at the Trumpet on the former German defense minister, Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg. The former economics minister, then he was the defense minister, and he's still very popular within Germany. When he was in politics, going back to around late 2000s, 2009-ish, he was a powerful force. He was very popular. He was forced to duck out in 2011 due to a plagiarism scandal. But what's he been doing since then? Well, he's been heavily involved in this new financial technology. In August 2013, zu Guttenberg founded Spitzberg Partners. They're a consultancy firm in New York. He said that our core mission is to help technology and financial services companies invest and expand their business in major European and emerging markets. He said that we have a unique background in high-level government positions and an excellent team with specialists in new technologies and financial markets. He said that the firm has a significant portion of fintech companies as his clients, so he's actively working with these different fintech groups. He's worked, for example, with the state of Delaware to try and incorporate some of this new financial technology into the way that that state engages and taxes businesses. Zu Guttenberg is also on the advisory board of Ripple. That's a major cryptocurrency, one of these new electronic currencies. It's a serious rival to the more famous Bitcoin. Handelsblatt wrote that unlike Bitcoin, Ripple is a cryptocurrency that works with banks around the world. It's been called the Bitcoin of banks. Zu Guttenberg himself wrote that Ripple is taking a wise middle course as they replace the centuries-old correspondent banking system, yet while integrating the affected banks through open, neutral protocols and finding solutions and linking them together. And it has partnered with some major banks, places like Santander, UniCredit, UBS, and the Frankfurter Raiffeisen Bank. Zu Guttenberg, he's also on the board of directors for the Mountain Partners, that's one of Switzerland's largest tech-focused investment firms, and he's become a regular at financial technology conferences. He is very well placed to play a key role in building the new financial system that we're expecting in Europe.
So thank you for that, Richard. You've connected some interesting dots here. Maybe you could just talk about how important these financial technologies are today. How influential, or what is the likelihood that you see of their growing in importance?
The second part is the billion-dollar question that if I could answer, would be able to become very rich. This is in very early stages. These technologies are being developed. There are about, I think, 1,800. It grows every time I look it up. Cryptocurrencies around today. It's a very trendy area, but I'd say mostly it's being used for speculation, mm-hmm. for different people trying to get rich quick, trying to gain attention. Some of it is being used for anonymous trading to try and use, say, Bitcoin if they want to buy products that they would be embarrassed if it caught back to them, or if those products are illegal, then using anonymous currency can be an important way of doing that. The big problem with Bitcoin is, even with the relatively limited use that they're being put to right now, 0.3% of the globe's total energy output is being put towards Bitcoin, according to the most recent estimates. So it is a hugely energy-intensive way of doing business. And this is one of the main criticisms of people like Noriel Roubini and other kind of Bitcoin skeptics, that don't see the technology going anywhere.
Yeah. But it is interesting to just look at possibilities. And you referenced that prophecy from Herbert W. Armstrong. Gerald Fleury has called that Mr. Armstrong's greatest personal prophecy about a banking crisis in America triggering European unification. It's not directly in biblical prophecy, but you can see several biblical prophecies that suggest that. And at the same time, you look at the world today and you see a lot of nations working to undermine America's economic dominance. So you really could see things moving toward the fulfillment of that prophecy.
Right. And you've got even just I'm writing right now on the fallout from the Iran deal and the way Europe is pretty horrified with that. I mean, Donald Trump's done a great thing in pulling out of the Iran deal, but Europe is very angry with that. And Europe, the way Donald Trump's pulled out, he's going to use America's financial dominance to try and force European countries not to do business with Iran, to punish European countries if they try and buy and sell from Iran. And so America's using its financial power, and Europe's kind of looking at those kind of things, and they're saying, well, America's got a big advantage in running the global financial system. They get a lot of political power out of it, a lot of economic power. I mean, you look at the amount of money America is able to borrow, and if they weren't the global reserve currency, there is no way people would be willing to lend them money and to buy dollars to the extent that they're doing right now.
Right.
So America gains a lot of advantages from that, and so there are other nations looking at that and eyeing that up.
Right. And just saying that the advantage of getting a certain amount of independence from the United States would be significant. And a lot of people are looking at China as being maybe the next economic superpower. What are the indications that you see that Europe is positioning itself to step into that role?
I don't think they are yet. I mean, you can look at the countries that are really moving on some of these cryptocurrencies are the ones that are coming under the most pressure from the United States. Like Venezuela is looking at coming up with like a kind of petrol-based cryptocurrency, the Petro. Russia is looking at coming up with a crypto ruble, a digital version of the ruble. China is looking into that. Europe is trying to maintain a functioning currency. They're trying to persuade Italy not to leave the Eurozone. They're trying to stop Greece from imploding and becoming a third world country. It just seems like they're not there. They need to get their own house in order before they can look at invading somebody else's.
Yeah. So that being the case, we're looking at Carl Theodor zu Guttenberg, and really he's a man that we've been watching for a number of reasons for a number of years. And so it's really the fact that he is so deeply enmeshed in these financial currencies that at least puts it on our radar screen that perhaps this is something that we need to be watching, especially considering the fact that these prophecies are so clear that the economic power of the European Empire is a major reason for its dominance.
Right. I think this was kind of some of the challenges in working on this article. There are endless different speculations of bits that are interesting with Bitcoin, with blockchain, with all of these different currencies, things that could go in this direction, could go in this direction. I mean, basically, it all rests upon an uneditable audit trail. That's what a blockchain basically is, something that's widely viewable, but is almost impossible to go back and edit. And you know, the state could use that to incredible length in terms of getting involved in the economy if they want to go down that route. And China has talked about doing that. And you look at some of these prophecies about no one can buy or sell without the approval of this coming power. And you know, something like that is very interesting. To kind of keep it on more concrete grounds rather than speculation, we know that the Bible says that there is this European power coming, that there is going to be a revolution in the financial system. The Bible also says that this European power is going to be led by a strong man. We've had our eye on who that strong man is for nearly 10 years now. And then when you see that strong man getting involved in finances, building up these contacts with banks, running firms that trade on their influence with governments, even getting involved in how some of this new type of financial technology is implemented at a governmental level, that has to become very interesting. That's where it just really kind of is on that much more firm grounding of Bible prophecy and is something we can really lock in on and watch.
Well, that's exactly what we'll do. We'll keep watching, and we sure appreciate you bringing this to our attention. We've been talking with trumpet writer Richard Palmer about fintech, financial technologies. He has an article he's written. This will appear in the next print edition of The Trumpet, which we're sending to the printer this week. So keep your eye on thetrumpet.com for that. That should be appearing sometime next week on the website. Thank you very much, Richard.
Thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
An avalanche of accusations and revelations of sexual impropriety and assault have made headlines in recent months. The media movements of Me Too, Don't Tell Me How to Dress, and Tell Men to Respect, Tell Men to Behave have many women telling their stories and many men being rightly exposed and often ruined for their wrongdoing. An important truth is being buried in this landslide. Before I say it, and even to make this suggestion invites anger and indignation, let's take a quick visit to Thailand. Every April, much of Southeast Asia welcomes the Hindu New Year with the Songkran Festival. It's one of the world's largest celebrations. In Thailand alone, this three-day celebration attracts over 500,000 foreigners, where it's widely known for its mass water fights. This festival has a dark side. Growing numbers of women report receiving unwanted sexual attention. In a survey of 1,650 women by a nonprofit organization last month, nearly 6 in 10 said they were sexually harassed at this year's festival. The Thai government published an official suggestion that if women wanted to avoid sexual assault, they should dress modestly. They give this advice every year, but this year, in the wake of the Me Too movement, the advice received a strong backlash. One well-known Thai actress created the hashtags "Don't tell me how to dress" and "Tell men to behave." In a widely viewed Instagram post, she wrote, "Women have the right to dress however we choose as long as it's not illegal. Sexual assault and harassment is never the woman's fault. Tell men to keep their hands to themselves." And she also tweeted, "Newsflash, women dress to feel beautiful and confident and sexy and powerful, to show off our toned bodies and our tans. We dress for ourselves, whether it's a bikini or a hijab. Don't tell me how to dress," she says. Well, according to Time Magazine, in Thailand, this hashtag, "Don't tell me how to dress," has created more buzz than hashtag Me Too. It's true that a man of top character isn't going to sexually harass a woman, no matter how she dresses. But this is quite an extraordinary notion, that a woman should be able to dress, in this woman's words, to feel beautiful and sexy, show off our toned bodies, and bear no responsibility for how this affects the men around her. A woman can dress to be noticed and to attract attention, to show off, and put 100% of the responsibility for knowing exactly how much attention and of what type is appropriate on the men around her. By this logic, when a man crosses that line, which would surely be different for different women, or even for the same woman in different circumstances, or depending on the man who crossed it, he bears 100% of the blame. This is deeply flawed thinking for several reasons. Most obviously, it is stunningly selfish. A woman who, as this actress described it, dresses only for herself, who purposefully dresses immodestly to show off and get noticed, is showing no consideration for the men around her. She's scoring shallow, ego-boosting victories at their expense. Now, clearly, there are many cases where women are not trying to attract attention and they still receive unwanted advances from lustful men. Even virtuous women get abused at times. You can see an example of that in 2 Samuel chapter 13. The world has its share of creeps. There's no question about that. Still, a woman does have the power to significantly reduce her chances of attracting unwanted attention from those creeps by where she goes, how she behaves, and yes, what she wears. I'm teaching my daughters, ages 16 and 14, to dress modestly in order to increase their chances of remaining safe and decrease the odds of drawing eyeballs from the wrong kind of men. For most of human history, in most of the world, such a statement would have been entirely unremarkable, totally uncontroversial, simple common sense. Today, it's considered backward, sexist, oppressive, and offensive. Last November, I wrote an article about the Harvey Weinstein scandal, and the main point that it made was that the sex scandals were a byproduct of breaking God's laws. This is what I wrote. Our society has renounced God's standards and laws. It mocks his morality and flouts his definitions of right and wrong. God condemns fornication, we embrace it. He condemns adultery, we accept it. He commands that sex be confined to within marriage, society sneers. Jesus Christ said merely looking on a woman lustfully is committing adultery in the heart. Matthew 5, verse 28. But we live in a pornographic playground and celebrate it. I wrote in that article, the Bible is loaded with instruction on how a real man should act. A man who is obeying God simply will not be taking advantage of women, harassing them, or using his power to secure sexual favors. Instead, he will be self-controlled, skilled at restraining his lusts, and faithful to his wife. God forbids men to be predators. He expects them to serve as women's protectors and defenders, and he commands men to regard women with honor. Now, critics are using the bad behavior of these predators to brand all men as dangerous, all masculinity as toxic. But the truth is that biblical masculinity, and more broadly, God's law, is a check on the toxicity that manifests itself in sexual predation. In that article, I also briefly made this complimentary point. On the flip side, God also commands modesty. He specifically says that women should dress and behave with modesty so as not to misuse the undeniable power of their sexuality. And in that article, I quoted a woman who wrote that our concept of modesty is rooted in the idea that women are sexual objects. Listen to what this woman is saying. She says, when we see a woman and condemn her clothing choices, we've accepted the idea that a woman's body is primarily sexual. Ankles, collarbones, shoulders, cleavage, knees, thighs, they're not treated as part of a person, but as objects that can tempt men to lust. Victim blaming is a cornerstone of Christian teachings about sexual purity. In this purity culture, women are to blame for what abusers do to them. Now, this is the don't tell me how to dress logic. And as I wrote in that article, apparently women should be able to dress and act however they want and expect men to treat them with platonic chastity and the highest honor. That's what I wrote in that article, and several readers took exception to what I wrote. And the suggestion that the sexual scandals could be reduced if we just returned to modesty. One woman accused me of suggesting that Muslims are righteous in God's eye. These are her words toward me. This is characterizing my belief that Muslims are righteous in God's eye because of their keeping women in their place, from hijabs to beatings, submission, female genital mutilation, and everything else the religion of peace, quote unquote, professes about women and their roles. You make the case they are justified in God's mind because of the way you interpret the Bible. Well, that is quite a condemnation. And this is an excellent example of the moral bluntness of this Me Too movement. If you suggest that a woman could help herself and others by covering her cleavage, in their mind, you are effectively a supporter, not just of hijabs, you know, head to foot coverings of women, but of beatings and genital mutilation. In January 2015, a woman named Veronica Partridge decided that she would no longer wear leggings, tight, form-fitting pants. And she wrote a blog post explaining why. And this post began this way. Disclaimer, let me just start off by saying I am in no way trying to tell people what they can and cannot wear. What you wear is entirely your own choice. I'm just sharing my personal story on why I chose to no longer wear yoga pants or leggings in public. As this woman saw it, leggings and other immodest articles of clothing, quote, create a stronger attraction for a man to look at a woman's body and may cause them to think lustful thoughts. And she talked with her husband, and her husband admitted that when you go into a room and women are wearing form-fitting clothing, then you have to consciously make yourself not look. You know, here's a news flash in case you haven't heard. Men are naturally attracted to the female form. And this is, you know, an important contributing factor to the perpetuation of the human race. But in this blog post, Veronica asked, if it's difficult for my husband, who loves, honors, and respects me, to keep his eyes focused ahead, then how much more difficult could it be for a man that may not have the same self-control? Sure, if a man wants to look, he's going to look. But why entice him? Is it possible that the thin, form-fitting leggings could make a married or single man look at a woman in a way he should only look at his wife? These were the words of Veronica Partridge on her blog. Good Morning America, a big nationwide morning program, they read the blog and they decided they were going to do a story on this stand that Veronica took. And the issue absolutely blew up. It provoked a heated backlash from the don't tell me how to dress public. They mercilessly ridiculed Veronica and her husband. And this is what Veronica wrote in a later post. These past few weeks have been shocking, to say the least. I have weathered the most hateful comments of my life. People have called me a countless number of names, some of which I can't even repeat. Women have talked about my husband with graphic sexuality, asking for favors and soliciting their bodies to him. I've seen the difference between disagreement and hate. Those who have said cruel words to me know that they have been felt. I understand how it feels to be disliked and bullied. So if the goal was to hurt me, you've succeeded. There's a bigger issue here about just the vileness of the left and its intolerance of biblical virtue. But just to keep to the specific issue at hand, whatever happened to modesty? When did this common sense quality become a form of oppression? Veronica made this point about just how selfish immodest dress is. She said, let's just say a woman walked into a park topless. Is it solely the man's responsibility to not look? No, responsible sexuality should be led by both men and women. When men or women act individually minded, thinking only of themselves rather than community minded, courteous of others, we put our culture in danger. And she says, you know, just because you can doesn't mean you should. Let's not forget that 25-year-old men aren't the only ones with eyes. If I'm individually minded, not thinking of how my outfit may affect others in my community, I might not realize the effect I have on my neighbor's 13-year-old son entering the age of sexuality. I might not realize the effect I have on a mother's daughter who may be struggling with the shape of her body. I might not realize the effect I have on the bus driver who may be fighting through his own battle with sexual addiction. So we're talking about the difference between living the way of give versus the way of get. It's demonstrating outgoing concern for others rather than just the self. It's good for a woman to dress flatteringly and to feel beautiful and feminine in what she wears, but her attire should be tasteful. The idea that a woman should be able to dress provocatively so that she can feel sexy and show off her toned body, in the words of that Thai actress, and expect men around her to give her exactly the kind of attention she wants and none of the attention she doesn't want, that is pure utopianist thinking. It exists only in fantasy. It is utterly ignorant of human nature. It's unpracticable in the real world. Like the idea that Marxism is good economics, just to overlook the track record of tragedy and failure. The reason it doesn't work is that it ignores instruction from our Creator, just like every other idea that human beings invent out of their own thinking. In his outstanding book, The Missing Dimension in Sex, Herbert W. Armstrong wrote about the differences that God created between the sexes when he made us male and female. God intends men to be protectors and defenders of women. And he also designed men psychologically and physically to be the initiators in a relationship with a woman. And he designed differences between the source of male and female sexual arousal. Men are visual. If a woman parades her body in indecent attire, it's naturally going to cause a man's mind to drift. Now, men have a responsibility to keep our minds in check, but considerate women will do what they can to avoid producing those thoughts. And if a woman wants to be respected and treated well, the way she dresses will help her achieve that goal as well. And certainly men should respect women, and women should respect these created differences between men and women. Dressing modestly isn't going to stop a perverted man from doing what he's already set his mind to do, but it can go a long way toward reducing the chances of bringing unwanted attention. Every woman has a certain power. And in today's world, women often use this power to manipulate men by the way they dress and behave. Now, that's not to make excuses for men who commit these crimes, but it's acknowledging that responsibility lies on all of us to maintain decency. Mr. Armstrong wrote about this power in The Missing Dimension in Sex. He was talking about the danger of sexual contact before marriage, but the principle applies to dress as well. He wrote this: many girls participating in necking on dates do not realize at all that the boyfriend is sexually aroused in a matter of 5 to 10 seconds time. And some girls, devoid of right understanding and character on learning this, deliberately resort to an embrace on the next date to try out their feminine powers. This is very foolish, very stupid, and very wrong. To any such girl, I say, you have only the very same power possessed by all the other 2 billion females in the world. Every cheap prostitute also has this power. This is what she sells in her despicable trade. Don't be like her. Don't pollute and misuse this wonderful power. God endowed you with these charms to be preserved for the one man to whom he will someday join you, to be used then in a wholesome manner that will produce blissful happiness. You'll be required to answer in the judgment for the manner in which you used your God-bestowed power. in the world today, a lot of women use and abuse this God-bestowed power. Just like Mr. Armstrong said, those feminine charms are intended for one man, her husband. But we live in a world that scoffs at the idea of sexual sanctity being preserved for marriage. Modesty has been tossed aside with many other values. And this is not a subject that people want to hear about. It's not politically correct to suggest that a woman dress with modesty, just as it's not politically correct to suggest that a man be a masculine leader, that he not abuse his power, but that he use his strength to fulfill his God-given role as protector and defender. It's not politically correct, but it's true. God specifies in the Bible the role that a man should play, the role that a woman should play. He gives a lot of examples of the happiness and joy that come when women of true, modest virtue conduct their lives according to his law. Modesty isn't about restricting what a woman can wear. It's about enhancing her quality of life because she's following God's guidelines. And just as God set those guidelines, he also prophesied of this degenerate age. He said through the prophet Isaiah, "Cry aloud, spare not, lift up your voice like a trumpet, and show my people their transgression and the house of Jacob their sins." Now, sin is the cause for all these sexual harassment cases. And God says, we've got to point those sins out. Now, obviously, modesty alone doesn't guarantee a woman's safety, but how much different would society be if men and women just obeyed his law? If we heeded Christ's instruction to his disciples in Matthew 22 to love your neighbor as yourself, take the selfless, loving approach, do what you can to help and to guard the other sex, even if that means dressing modestly rather than just dressing for yourself. Dress for other people to preserve sexual sanctity. Immodesty is selfish. That's an attitude that God hates. He wants us to be looking out for each other. We are the workmanship of God's hands. He created our bodies, and he instructs us how he wants us to take care of ourselves. So we need to be looking to him for instruction on dress. And you can see in 1 Timothy 2 and verse 9, in like manner also that women adorn themselves in modest apparel. The Apostle Paul gives this instruction from God that women dress with modesty. God isn't concerned with, you know, how trendy or in style someone is dressed. He's looking at the heart, and he's concerned with how diligently we're seeking to obey him. This wonderful being who created men and women gives us a lot of instruction on what we can do to preserve sexual sanctity. Both men and women have a part to play. And God makes it clear we both have responsibility in this. He created us to help one another, to work together as a team, to help be a benefit to one another. And we all need to evaluate how well we're doing against life's instruction manual. Do all you can to show love in all things, even in how you dress.
It's time for today's last word.
In a classic story told by Daniel Lappin, an old teacher was flying on an airplane and found himself seated next to a prominent liberal politician. Soon after the plane took off, one of the teacher's students, who was sitting a few rows back, began waiting on his master, hand and foot. "Sir, let me take your shoes. Here's a pair of slippers. I know how your feet tend to swell. Here's a sandwich. I know how you hate airline food." Finally, the politician spoke up. "That's amazing. I'm so impressed with your son. I have 4 grown sons, and they never do anything for me. How do you get him to serve you so diligently?" The teacher responded, "Actually, he's my student. If he were my son, you would have really seen service. But you mustn't blame yourself. Your sons are faithful to your teachings, and my sons are faithful to my teachings. It's simple, you see. You made the decision to teach your sons that you're descended from apes. That means that you are one generation closer to the ape than they. And that means that it's only proper and appropriate that you acknowledge their status and that you serve them. But you see, I chose to teach my sons that we were created by the Almighty God himself. And that puts me one generation closer to him, which means that it's appropriate that they treat me accordingly." God is a strong advocate of passing down instruction from generation to generation. He wants godly knowledge to grow within families. He wants children to be instructed not only by their parents, but also their grandparents. That means the older must have a mind to teach those younger, and the younger must have a mind to learn from those older. God wants children growing up with a sense of honor toward their elders, and adults developing as teachers as we age. Everybody benefits. God loves to see a family business lasting generations, a father teaching his trade to his sons, sons tracing the footsteps of their father. Jesus Christ himself exemplified this principle. You can see in Luke 2 and verse 49. Without family education, each generation starts from scratch, stumbling through life, making the same mistakes as the one before. An old plain truth made this point. Imagine, if you will, a person going through kindergarten, grammar school, junior high school, junior college, college, doing postgraduate work, sacrificing, working hard, finally obtaining a doctorate in some field, and then being told he must quit and be unproductive the rest of his days. Sound unreasonable? It would be. Most older people have gone through the school of hard knocks. By experience, they've learned valuable lessons about handling life's difficult moments, as well as its rewarding moments. And what happens when they're at the stage in life where they could share that information with younger generations? The younger generations, for the most part, turn a deaf ear. Modern youth-oriented society, as it is set up, simply does not warmly welcome the participation of the elderly. It does not, as a whole, show a genuine interest in the well-being of its senior members. In society at large, God has removed the benefit of the wise leadership of the ancient. You can see in Isaiah 3, children and babes rule in their place and behave proudly against their elders. We need to recognize this crisis and take whatever steps we can to correct it in our own lives. Both parties in the interaction, old and young, are responsible for making it work. Older people can often see younger people making mistakes and stumbling through life, ignorant of the consequences of their choices. And as much as we may want to look away and leave them to their own devices, God repeatedly seeks to instill in those with wisdom and experience a sense of duty toward those without it. Read passages like Deuteronomy 6, Exodus 13, Joshua 4, Psalm 78. They're just a few of the dozens of scriptures that demonstrate this important principle. And of course, young people need to be receptive to that knowledge. That's why it's critical for them to be trained and taught to be receptive. How does God want the ancient treated? Leviticus 19, verse 22 says, "You shall rise up before the hoary head," or that's talking about the gray hairs of the aged, "and honor the face of the old man, and fear your God. I am the Lord." The New International Version renders this verse, "Rise in the presence of the aged, show respect for the elderly, and revere your God." You can see in that verse how God links the concept of respecting the elderly with revering him. They're connected. After all, God is the Ancient of Days. Rich intergenerational relationships, rich with teaching by those elder and respect by those younger, are a tremendous resource we cannot afford not to cultivate. They are truly one of the most satisfying blessings a God-centered family life has to offer. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Send us your comments on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Brent Nachtigall and Richard Palmer. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Sidney Howard Gay. "Pride is to character like the attic to the house, the highest part and generally the most empty." Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.